Dietary Goals for the United States by the Senate's Selection Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs in 1977. As you can imagine, the goals aimed to lower fat intake and avoid foods high in cholesterol. Artery-clogging saturated fats were deemed especially bad. So down went meat, milk, eggs, butter, cheese, and tropical oils such as coconut and palm oil. This perspective also paved the way for the billion-dollar drug industry's focus on lipid-lowering medications. At the same time, health authorities began to advise people to replace these now bad fats with carbohydrates and processed polyunsaturated vegetable oils, including soybean, corn, cottonseed, canola, peanut, safflower, and sunflower oils. Fast food restaurants followed suit in the mid-1980s, switching from beef fat and palm oil to partially hydrogenated, trans fat, vegetable oil to fry their foods. Even though the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, has since converted its food guide from a pyramid to a plate, it still communicates the idea that fat is bad and carbs are good. In fact, the new My Plate doesn't feature fats at all, making it very confusing for consumers to know how fats fit into a healthy diet and which kind. Dr. Donald W. Miller, cardiac surgeon and professor of surgery at the University of Washington, stated it perfectly in his 2010 essay entitled Health Benefits of a Low-Carbohydrate, High-Saturated Fat Diet. The 60-year reign of the low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet will end. This will happen when the health-destroying effects of excess carbohydrates in the diet become more widely recognized and the health benefits of saturated fats are better appreciated. The lipid hypothesis has dominated cardiovascular circles for decades, despite the fact that the number of contradictory studies exceeds those that are supportive. There hasn't been a published study in the last 30 years that has unequivocally demonstrated that lowering serum cholesterol by eating a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet prevents or reduces heart attack or death rate. And, as Dr. Miller points out, population studies from around the world do not support the lipid hypothesis. We can even go as far back as 1968 to find studies that flatly dispel the notion of a low-fat diet as ideal. That year, the International Atherosclerosis Project examined 22,000 corpses from 14 nations and found that it didn't matter whether people ate large amounts of fatty animal products or followed a mostly vegetarian diet. The prevalence of arterial plaque was the same in all parts of the world, both in those with high rates of heart disease and in populations with little to no heart disease. Which means that the thickening of the arterial wall could just be an unavoidable process of aging that doesn't necessarily correlate with clinical heart disease. So, if eating saturated fat doesn't cause heart disease, then what does? Now, let's look at these circumstances from the perspective of the brain, and then we'll circle back to matters of the heart. You'll soon be able to understand the root cause of both obesity and brain disease. Carbs, diabetes, and brain disease. As I've already detailed, one of the ways in which grains and carbs set fire to the brain is through surges in blood sugar. This has direct negative effects on the brain that in turn start the inflammatory cascade. The science really comes down to your body's neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters are your main mood and brain regulators, and when your blood sugar increases, there's an immediate depletion of the neurotransmitters serotonin, epinephrine, norepinephrine, GABA, and dopamine. At the same time, B-complex vitamins, which are needed to make those neurotransmitters and a few hundred other things, get used up. Magnesium levels also diminish, and this handicaps both your nervous system and liver. In addition, high blood sugar triggers a reaction called glycation, which we'll explore in detail in the next chapter. In simplest terms, Glycation is the biological process whereby glucose, proteins, and certain fats become tangled together, causing tissues and cells to become stiff and inflexible, including those in the brain. More specifically, sugar molecules and brain proteins combine to create deadly new structures that contribute more than any other factor to the degeneration of the brain and its functioning. The brain is tremendously vulnerable to the glycating ravages of glucose, and this is made worse when powerful antigens like gluten accelerate the damage. In neurological terms, glycation can contribute to the shrinking of critical brain tissue. Aside from sweetened beverages, grain-based foods are responsible for the bulk of carbohydrate calories in the American diet. Whether from pasta, cookies, cakes, bagels, or the seemingly healthful whole grain bread, the carbohydrate load induced by our food choices ultimately doesn't serve us well when trying to optimize brain health and function. When you add to this list the potpourri of other high-carbohydrate foods like potatoes, corn, fruit, and rice, it's no wonder that Americans are now rightly called carboholics. It's also not surprising that we have an epidemic of metabolic dysfunction and diabetes in our culture. The data confirming the relationship between high-carbohydrate consumption and diabetes is clear and profound. And it's compelling to note that in 1994, when the American Diabetes Association recommended that Americans should consume 60 to 70% of their calories from carbohydrates, rates of diabetes exploded. In fact, the number of cases of diabetes in this country actually doubled between 1997 and 2007. In the accompanying PDF, take a look at the rapid upward slope from 1980 through 2011, during which the number of Americans diagnosed with diabetes more than tripled. This is significant, since, as you already know, becoming a diabetic doubles your risk of Alzheimer's disease. Even being pre-diabetic, when blood sugar issues are just beginning, is associated with a decline in brain function and shrinkage of the brain's memory center. It is also an independent risk factor for full-blown Alzheimer's disease. It's hard to believe that we couldn't have known about this connection between diabetes and dementia sooner, but it's taken us a long time to connect the dots and conduct the kind of longitudinal studies that such a conclusion requires. It's also taken us time to figure out the obvious question that stems from this link. How does diabetes contribute to dementia? First, if you're insulin resistant, your body may not be able to break down a protein, amyloid, that forms brain plaques associated with brain disease. Second, high blood sugar provokes menacing biological reactions that injure the body by producing certain oxygen-containing molecules that damage cells and causing inflammation that can result in hardening and narrowing of the arteries in the brain, not to mention elsewhere in the body. This condition, known as atherosclerosis, can lead to vascular dementia, which occurs when blockages and strokes kill brain tissue. We tend to think about atherosclerosis in terms of the heart, but the brain can be equally affected by changes in its arteries' walls. Back in 2004, Australian researchers boldly stated in a review paper that there is now a consensus that atherosclerosis represents a state of heightened oxidative stress characterized by lipid and protein oxidation in the vascular wall. They also pointed out that such oxidation is a response to inflammation. A most disturbing finding was made by Japanese researchers in 2011 when they looked at 1,000 men and women over age 60 and found that people with diabetes were twice as likely as the other study participants to develop Alzheimer's disease within 15 years. They were also 1.75 times more likely to develop dementia of any kind. This link remained true even after they took into account several factors associated with both diabetes and dementia risk, such as age, sex, blood pressure, and body mass index. Now, They and other researchers are documenting how controlling blood sugar and reducing risk factors for type 2 diabetes also reduces dementia risk. Get the facts on fat, your brain's best friend. To fully grasp the bane of carbs and the benefits of fats, it helps to understand some basic biology. In the body, dietary carbohydrates, including sugars and starches, are converted to glucose, which you know by now tells the pancreas to release insulin into the blood. Insulin shuffles glucose into cells and stores glucose as glycogen in the liver and muscles. It's also the body's chief fat-building catalyst, converting glucose to body fat when the liver and muscles have no more room for glycogen. Carbohydrates, not dietary fats, are the primary cause of weight gain. Think about it. Many farmers fatten animals destined for the butcher block with carbohydrates like corn and grain, not fats and proteins. This partly explains why one of the major health effects of a low-carbohydrate diet is weight loss. Moreover, a low-carb diet decreases blood sugar in diabetics and improves insulin sensitivity. In fact, replacing carbohydrates with fat is increasingly becoming the preferred method for treating type 2 diabetes. When your diet is continuously rich in carbohydrates, which in effect keep your insulin pumps on, you severely limit, if not completely halt, the breakdown of your body fat for fuel. Your body gets addicted to that glucose. You may even use up your glucose, but still suffer from a lockdown of available fat for fuel due to high volumes of insulin. In essence, the body becomes physically starved due to your carb-based diet. This is why many obese individuals cannot lose weight while continuing to eat carbs. Their insulin levels hold those fat storages hostage. Now, let's turn to fat. Fat is and always has been a fundamental pillar of our nutrition. Beyond the fact that the human brain consists of more than 70% fat, fat plays a pivotal role in regulating the immune system. Simply stated, good fats like omega-3s and monounsaturated fats reduce inflammation, while modified hydrogenated fats, so common in commercially prepared foods, dramatically increase inflammation. Certain vitamins, notably A, D, E, and K, require fat to get absorbed properly in the body, which is why dietary fat is necessary to transport these fat-soluble vitamins. Because these vitamins do not dissolve in water, they can only be absorbed from your small intestine in combination with fat. Deficiencies due to incomplete absorption of these vitally important vitamins are always serious, and any such deficiency can be linked to brain illness, among many other conditions. Without enough vitamin K, for instance, you won't be able to form blood clots upon injury and can even suffer from spontaneous bleeding. Imagine that problem in the brain. Vitamin K also contributes to both brain and eye health, helping reduce the risk of age-related dementia and macular degeneration. And dietary fat is good for macular degeneration. Without adequate vitamin A, your brain won't develop properly. You will go blind and become exceptionally vulnerable to infections. A lack of vitamin D is known to be associated with increased susceptibility to several chronic diseases, including schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, depression, seasonal affective disorders, and a number of autoimmune diseases such as type 1 diabetes. If you follow today's conventional wisdom, you know that you're supposed to limit your total fat intake to no more than 20% of your calories, and when it comes to saturated, that percentage goes down to less than 10. You also know that this is difficult to achieve. You can breathe a sigh of relief. It's misguided advice, and on my program you won't have to worry about counting fat grams or overall percentages. However, while the synthetic trans fats found in margarine and processed foods are poisonous, we know now that monounsaturated fats, such as the fat found in avocados, olives, and nuts, are healthy. We also know that the polyunsaturated omega-3 fatty acids in cold water fish, for example, salmon, and some plants, for example, flaxseed oil, are deemed good. But what about natural saturated fats such as those found in meat, egg yolks, cheese, and butter? As I've been detailing, saturated fat has gotten a bad rap. Most of us don't even question why these particular fats are unhealthy anymore. We just assume that the purported science is true. Or we erroneously place these fats in the same category as trans fats. But we need saturated fat, and our body has long been designed to handle the consumption of natural sources of it, even in high amounts. Few people understand that saturated fat plays a pivotal role in a lot of biochemical equations that keep us healthy. If you were breastfed as a baby, then saturated fats were your staple, as they make up 54% of the fat in breast milk. Every cell in your body requires saturated fats. They comprise 50% of the cellular membrane. They also contribute to the structure and function of your lungs, heart, bones, liver, and immune system. In your lungs, one particular saturated fat, 16-palmitic acid, creates lung surfactant, reducing surface tension so that your alveoli, the tiny air sacs that capture oxygen from your inhalations and allow it to be absorbed into your bloodstream, are able to expand. Without surfactant, you would not be able to breathe because the wet surfaces of your lungs' alveoli would stick together and prevent your lungs from expanding. Having healthy lung surfactant prevents asthma and other breathing disorders. Heart muscle cells prefer a type of saturated fat for nourishment, and bones require saturated fats to assimilate calcium effectively. With the help of saturated fats, your liver clears out fat and protects you from the adverse effects of toxins, including alcohol and compounds in medications. The white blood cells of your immune system partly owe their ability to recognize and destroy invading germs, as well as to fight tumors, to the fats found in butter and coconut oil. Even your endocrine system relies on saturated fatty acids to communicate the need to manufacture certain hormones, including insulin. And they help tell your brain when you are full, so you can pull away from the table. I don't expect you to remember all this biology. I mention it as a way of emphatically expressing to you the biological necessity of saturated fat. The case for cholesterol. If you've had your cholesterol levels tested, you've probably lumped HDL, high-density lipoprotein, and LDL, low-density lipoprotein, into two different categories, one good and one bad. I've already mentioned these two labels for cholesterol in passing, but contrary to what you might think, they are not two different kinds of cholesterol. HDL and LDL reflect two different containers for cholesterol and fats, each of which serves a different role in the body. Several other lipoproteins also exist, such as VLDL, very low, and IDL, intermediate. And as I've already begun to outline, cholesterol, no matter which kind, is not as terrible as you've been taught to believe. Some of the most remarkable studies of late on the biological value of cholesterol, and for brain health in particular, clue us in to how the pieces to this puzzle fit together and tell a coherent story. As we've seen, science is only recently discovering that both fat and cholesterol are severely deficient in diseased brains, and that high total cholesterol levels in late life are associated with increased longevity. The brain holds only 2% of the body's mass, but contains 25% of the total cholesterol, which supports brain function and development. 1/5 of the brain by weight is cholesterol. Cholesterol forms membranes surrounding cells, keeps cell membranes permeable, and maintains cellular waterproofing so different chemical reactions can take place inside and outside the cell. We've actually determined that the ability to grow new synapses in the brain depends on the availability of cholesterol, which latches cell membranes together so that signals can easily jump across the synapse. It's also a crucial component in the myelin coating around the neuron, allowing quick transmission of information. A neuron that can't transmit messages is useless, and it only makes sense to cast it aside like junk, the debris of which is the hallmark of brain disease. In essence, cholesterol acts as a facilitator for the brain to communicate and function properly. Moreover, cholesterol in the brain serves as a powerful antioxidant. It protects the brain against the damaging effects of free radicals. Cholesterol is a precursor for the steroid hormones like estrogen and the androgens, as well as for vitamin D, a critically important fat-soluble antioxidant. Vitamin D is also a powerful anti-inflammatory, helping to rid the body of infectious agents that can lead to life-threatening diseases. Vitamin D is not really a vitamin. It acts more like a steroid in the body or a hormone. Given that vitamin D is directly formed from cholesterol, you won't be surprised to hear that vitamin D levels are low in people with a variety of neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and multiple sclerosis. As we age, natural cholesterol levels generally increase in the body. This is good, because as we age, our production of free radicals increases. Cholesterol can offer a level of protection against these free radicals. And beyond the brain, cholesterol plays other vital roles in human health and physiology. The bile salts secreted by the gallbladder, which are needed for the digestion of fat and therefore the absorption of fat-soluble vitamins like A, D, and K, are made of cholesterol. Having a low cholesterol level in the body would therefore compromise a person's ability to digest fat. It would also jeopardize your body's electrolyte balance since cholesterol helps manage that delicate equilibrium. In fact, cholesterol is regarded by the body as such an important collaborator that every cell has a way to make its own supply. So what does this mean for dietary recommendations? For years, we have been told to focus on low cholesterol foods, but foods rich in cholesterol, such as eggs, are very helpful and should be considered brain food. We have eaten cholesterol-rich foods for more than 2 million years. As you now know, the real culprits when it comes to decreased brain function and health are foods that are high in glycemic index, basically high in carbohydrate. One of the most pervasive myths I'm constantly debunking is the notion that the brain prefers glucose for fuel. This also couldn't be further from the truth. The brain uses fat exceptionally well. It is considered a brain superfuel. This is why we use a fat-based diet as therapy for all manner of neurodegenerative diseases. Later on, I describe in detail how the brain accesses fat for fuel and what this means for health and for tailoring the perfect diet. Part of the reason I am focusing on fats and cholesterol in particular is not only because these ingredients have everything to do with brain health, but also because we live in a society that continues to demonize them, and the huge pharmaceutical industry preys on the public's misinformation and perpetuates falsehoods, many of which could physically destroy us. To really understand where I'm going with this, let's look at one problematic area, the statin epidemic. The statin epidemic and the link to brain dysfunction. Our understanding of how cholesterol is critical for brain health has brought me and many others in my field to believe that statins, the blockbuster drugs prescribed to millions of Americans to lower cholesterol, may cause or exacerbate brain disorders and disease. Memory dysfunction is a known side effect of statins. Dr. Dwayne Graveline, a former doctor to NASA astronauts who earned the nickname Space Doc, has been a strong opponent of statins. Ever since he experienced total memory loss that he believed was caused by the statins he was taking at the time, he has been collecting evidence of their side effects from people around the world. Today, he has written three books on the matter, the most famous of which is Lipitor, Thief of Memory. In February 2012, the FDA released a statement indicating that statin drugs could cause cognitive side effects such as memory lapses and confusion. One recent study performed by the American Medical Association and published in the Archives of Internal Medicine in January 2012 demonstrated an astounding 48% increased risk of diabetes among women taking statin medications. This study involved big numbers, more than 160,000 postmenopausal women, making it hard to ignore its significance and gravity. Recognizing that type 2 diabetes is a powerful risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, a relationship between statin drugs and cognitive decline or cognitive dysfunction is certainly understandable. In 2009, Stephanie Seneff, a senior research scientist in the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT, who recently became interested in the effects of drugs and diet on health and nutrition, wrote a compelling essay explaining why low-fat diets and statins may cause Alzheimer's. In it, she chronicles our knowledge of statins' side effects and paints a stunning portrait of how the brain suffers in their presence. She also synthesizes the latest science and input from other experts in the field. As Dr. Seneff explains, one of the main reasons statins promote brain disorder is that they handicap the liver's ability to make cholesterol. Consequently, the level of LDL in the blood drops significantly. As I've just detailed, cholesterol plays a vital role in the brain, enabling communication between neurons and encouraging the growth of new brain cells. In an ironic twist, the statin industry advertises its products by saying that they interfere with cholesterol production in the brain as well as in the liver. Professor of biophysics at Iowa State University, Dr. Yong-Kyung Shin, is a noted authority on how cholesterol functions within neural networks to transmit messages. He put it bluntly in an interview for a Science Daily reporter. If you deprive cholesterol from the brain, then you directly affect the machinery that triggers the release of neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters affect the data processing and memory functions. In other words, how smart you are and how well you remember things. If you try to lower the cholesterol by taking medication that is attacking the machinery of cholesterol synthesis in the liver, that medicine goes to the brain too, and then it reduces the synthesis of cholesterol, which is necessary in the brain. Our study shows there is a direct link between cholesterol and the neurotransmitter release, and we know exactly the molecular mechanics of what happens in the cells. Cholesterol changes the shape of the proteins to stimulate thinking and memory. In 2009, an updated review of two major studies completed in 2001 of statin medications used by more than 26,000 individuals at risk for dementia and Alzheimer's disease showed that statins are not protective against Alzheimer's, which contradicted previous thinking. The lead author of the study, Bernadette McGinnis, was quoted by Science Daily as saying, "From these trials, which contained very large numbers and were the gold standard, it appears that statins given in late life to individuals at risk of vascular disease do not prevent against dementia." When asked to comment on the results, UCLA researcher Beatrice Golem said, "Regarding statins as preventive medicines, there are a number of individual cases in case reports and case series where cognition is clearly and reproducibly adversely affected by statins." Golam further added that various studies have demonstrated that statins either negatively affected cognition or were neutral, and that no trial has ever shown a positive outcome. Besides statins' direct impact on cholesterol, they have an indirect effect on the supply of fatty acids and antioxidants. They not only reduce the amount of cholesterol contained in LDL particles, but also diminish the actual number of LDL particles. So in addition to depleting cholesterol, they limit the stash available to the brain of both fatty acids and antioxidants, which are also carried in the LDL particles. Proper brain functioning depends on all three of these substances. And later on, you'll hear about the importance of boosting the body's own natural production of antioxidants. Another way in which statins may contribute to Alzheimer's, beautifully described by Dr. Seneff, is by paralyzing cells' ability to make coenzyme Q10, a vitamin-like substance found throughout the body, where it serves an important role as an antioxidant and in producing energy for cells. Because coenzyme Q10 shares the same metabolic pathway as cholesterol, its synthesis is disrupted by statins, and the body and brain are deprived of it. Some of the side effects listed for statins, such as fatigue, shortness of breath, problems with mobility and balance, and muscular pain, weakness, and atrophy, are related to the loss of CoQ10 in muscles and a reduced capacity for energy production. At the extreme, people who experience severe reactions to statins suffer from serious damage to their skeletal muscles. A deficiency in CoQ10 also has been linked to heart failure, hypertension, and Parkinson's disease. Given all these effects, it's logical to see why CoQ10 has been proposed as an actual treatment for Alzheimer's disease. Finally, statins could have an indirect effect on vitamin D. The body makes vitamin D from cholesterol in the skin upon exposure to UV rays from the sun. If you were to look at the chemical formula for vitamin D, you'd have a hard time distinguishing it from cholesterol's formula. They look virtually identical. If LDL levels are kept artificially low, writes Dr. Seneff, then the body will be unable to resupply adequate amounts of cholesterol to replenish the stores in the skin once they have been depleted. This would lead to vitamin D deficiency, which is a widespread problem in America. Vitamin D deficiency is not just about an increased risk for weak, soft bones, and at the extreme end, rickets. It's associated with many conditions that heighten one's risk for dementia, such as diabetes, depression, and cardiovascular disease. If the brain didn't demand vitamin D for proper development and function, then it wouldn't have widespread receptors for it. The benefits of statins are questionable, and major studies have failed to show how they protect the body from illness. Although numerous studies do point to the positive effects statins have on reducing mortality rates in people with coronary artery disease, new research reveals that these outcomes have little to do with the cholesterol-lowering activity of these drugs and more likely reflect the fact that they reduce inflammation, a mainspring of the disease. But that doesn't mean that the trade-offs for taking a statin merit their seal of approval. For some, the risk of negative side effects is just too great. People with a low risk of heart disease but a high risk for other ailments would be putting themselves in harm's way if they chose to take a statin. Studies dating back to the mid-1990s reveal a link between statin use and an increased risk of certain cancers, not to mention a long list of side effects from digestive challenges to asthma, impotence, inflammation of the pancreas, and liver damage. A trial published in January 2010 in the American Journal of Cardiology found that statin medications actually increased the risk of death. Researchers in Israel followed nearly 300 adults diagnosed with heart failure for an average of 3.7 years, and in some cases up to 11.5 years. Those who were taking statin drugs and had the lowest levels of low-density lipoprotein, LDL, were found to have the highest rates of mortality. Conversely, people with higher levels of cholesterol had a lower risk of death. How carbs, not cholesterol, cause high cholesterol. If you can limit carb intake to a range that is absolutely necessary, and make up the difference with delicious fats and protein, you can literally reprogram your genes back to the factory setting you had at birth. This is the setting that affords you the ability to be a mentally sharp, fat-burning machine. It's important to understand that when you have a blood cholesterol test, the number that is represented is actually 75 to 80% derived from what your body manufactures, and not necessarily what you've eaten. In fact, foods that are high in cholesterol actually decrease the body's production of cholesterol. We all make up to 2,000 grams of cholesterol every day because we desperately need it, and this is several times the amount found in our diets. But despite this amazing ability, it's critical to obtain cholesterol from dietary sources. Our bodies much prefer that we spoon-feed our cholesterol from the foods we eat rather than manufacture it internally, which is a complex, multi-step biological process that taxes the liver. Dietary cholesterol is so important that your body absorbs as much as it can for use. So what happens if you restrict your cholesterol intake, as so many people do today? The body sends out an alarm that indicates crisis. Famine. Your liver senses this signal and begins to produce an enzyme called HMG-CoA reductase, which helps make up for the deficit by using carbohydrates in the diet to produce an excess supply of cholesterol. This is the same enzyme that statins target. As you can likely predict, it's a Molotov cocktail in the works. As you eat excessive carbohydrates while lowering your cholesterol intake, you incite a steady and punishing overproduction of cholesterol in the body. The only way to stop this internal pathway run amok is to consume an adequate amount of dietary cholesterol and back way off on carbs. Which explains why my high cholesterol patients who go on my diet can safely return their levels to normal without drugs while enjoying cholesterol-laden foods. Is there such a thing as dangerously high cholesterol? Cholesterol is, at most, a minor player in coronary heart disease and represents an extremely poor predictor of heart attack risk. Over half of all patients hospitalized with a heart attack have cholesterol levels in the normal range. The idea that aggressively lowering cholesterol levels will somehow magically and dramatically reduce heart attack risk has now been fully and categorically refuted. The most important modifiable risk factors related to heart attack risk include smoking, excess alcohol consumption, lack of aerobic exercise, overweight, and a diet high in carbohydrates. So when I see patients with cholesterol levels of, say, 240 milligrams per deciliter or higher, it's almost a given that they will have received a prescription for a cholesterol-lowering medication from their general practitioners. This is wrong in thought and action. As discussed, cholesterol is one of the most critical chemicals in human physiology, especially as it relates to brain health. The best lab report to refer to in determining one's health status is hemoglobin A1C, not cholesterol levels. It is rarely, if ever, appropriate to consider high cholesterol alone to be a significant threat to health. A good question. Who suffers from high cholesterol? 30 years ago, the answer was anyone whose cholesterol level was more than 240 and who had other risk factors, such as being overweight and smoking. The definition changed after the Cholesterol Consensus Conference in 1984. Then it became anyone with a cholesterol level over 200, regardless of other risk factors. Today, the threshold is down to 180. And if you've had a heart attack, you're in a totally different category. No matter how low your cholesterol level is, you'll likely be prescribed a cholesterol-lowering medicine and told to maintain a low-fat diet. Sex ed. It's all in your head. Okay, so cholesterol is a good thing. But it's not just about your brain's wit, physical health, and future longevity. It's also about a very important part of your lifestyle that typically gets shoved under the carpet in serious health books. I'm talking about your sex life. How sparky is it? Although I'm a neurologist, I treat a fair share of people who suffer from sexual dysfunction and are either impotent and avoid sex altogether, or who hoard bottles of pills to help them out. You know about these pills, the ones that get advertised like candy on the evening news and promise to transform your sex life? My patients with sexual health woes obviously don't come to me for that specifically, but it's a noted problem when I ask them about that part of their life, in addition to any neurological issues I am addressing. A quick anecdote. A 75-year-old retired engineer came to see me with a variety of complaints, including insomnia and depression. He had been taking sleeping pills for the past 40 years, and his depression had worsened in the 2 to 3 months prior to his appointment. At the time I saw him, he was actually taking a few drugs, an antidepressant, a medication for anxiety, and Viagra for erectile dysfunction. I first checked him for gluten sensitivity and discovered, to his surprise, a positive panel. He agreed to adopt a gluten-free, high-fat diet, and we next communicated by telephone after about 1 month. That's when he had magnificent news. His depression had improved, and he no longer needed to take Viagra in order to have sex with his wife. He thanked me very much. Most everyone can agree that sex has everything to do with what's going on in the brain. It's an act that's deeply tied to emotions, impulses, and thoughts. But it's also inexorably connected to hormones and blood chemistry. Without question, if you're depressed and not sleeping well, like my engineer patient, sex is the last thing on your mind. But one of the most common reasons for impotence is actually neither of these two conditions. It's what I've been talking about through much of this chapter. Abysmally low cholesterol levels. And the studies to date have achieved proof of concept. Unless you have healthy testosterone levels, this goes for both men and women, you're not going to have a hot sex life, if any at all. And what makes testosterone? Cholesterol. What are millions of Americans doing today? Lowering their cholesterol levels through diet and/or taking statins. In the meanwhile, they are lowering their libido and ability to perform. Is it any wonder there's an epidemic of erectile dysfunction, ED, and demand for ED drugs today? Not to mention, perhaps ironically, testosterone replacement therapy? Plenty of studies have confirmed these connections. Decreased libido is one of the most common complaints among those taking statins, and lab reports have repeatedly demonstrated low testosterone in statin consumers. Those on statins are twice as likely to have low testosterone levels. Luckily, this condition is reversible by stopping the statin and increasing cholesterol intake. There are actually two ways that statins can lower testosterone. The first is by directly lowering levels of cholesterol. The second is by interfering with the enzymes that create active testosterone. One study that came out in the United Kingdom in 2010 looked at 930 men with coronary heart disease and measured their testosterone levels. Low testosterone was found in 24% of the patients, and the risk of dying was 12% in those with normal testosterone, but 21% in those with low testosterone. The conclusion was staring them in the face. If you have coronary disease and low testosterone, you're at much greater risk of dying. So again, we are giving statin medications to lower cholesterol, which lowers testosterone, and lower testosterone increases the risk of dying. Is this crazy or what? I rest my case. The sweet truth. I've covered a lot of ground in this chapter, mostly dealing with the role of fats on the brain. But we now have to ask ourselves the following. What happens when you inundate the brain with sugar instead? I started this chapter by addressing the ills of carbohydrates on our bodies, but I've saved the conversation about this particularly devastating carbohydrate for its own chapter. Unfortunately, this is a subject area that's gotten remarkably little attention in the press. We increasingly hear about the relationship between sugar and diabesity, sugar and heart disease, sugar and fatty livers, sugar and metabolic syndrome, sugar and risk for cancer, etc. But sugar and brain dysfunction? It's time you got up close and personal with your brain on sugar. Chapter 4. Not a Fruitful Union. This is your brain on sugar, natural or not. Evolutionarily, sugar was available to our ancestors as fruit for only a few months a year, at harvest time, or as honey, which was guarded by bees. But in recent years, sugar has been added to nearly all processed foods, limiting consumer choice. Nature made sugar hard to get. Man made it easy. Dr. Robert Lustig and others. Sugar, whether it's from a lollipop, Lucky Charms, or a slice of cinnamon raisin bread, we all know that this particular carbohydrate is not the healthiest of ingredients, especially when it's consumed in excess or comes from refined or processed forms such as high fructose corn syrup. We also know that sugar is partly to blame for challenges with our waistlines, appetites, blood sugar control, obesity, type 2 diabetes, and insulin resistance. But what about sugar and the brain? In 2011, Gary Taubes, the author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, wrote an excellent piece for the New York Times titled, Is Sugar Toxic? In it, he chronicles not just the history of sugar in our lives and food products, but the evolving science behind understanding how sugar affects our bodies. In particular, he showcases the work of Robert Lustig, a specialist in pediatric hormone disorders and the leading expert in childhood obesity at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, who makes a case for sugar being a toxin or a poison. But Lustig doesn't harp so much on the consumption of these empty calories. His issue with sugar is that it has unique characteristics, specifically in the way the various kinds of sugar are metabolized by the human body. Lustig likes to use the phrase isocaloric but not isometabolic when he describes the difference between pure glucose, the simplest form of sugar, and table sugar, which is a combination of glucose and fructose. Fructose, which I'll get to in a moment, is a type of naturally occurring sugar found exclusively in fruit and honey. When we eat 100 calories of glucose from a potato, for instance, our bodies metabolize it differently and experience different effects than if we were to eat 100 calories of sugar comprising half glucose and half fructose. Here's why. Your liver takes care of the fructose component of sugar. Glucose from other carbs and starches, on the other hand, is processed by every cell in the body. So consuming both types of sugar, fructose and glucose, at the same time, means your liver has to work harder than if you ate the same number of calories from glucose alone. And your liver will also be taxed if it's hit with liquid forms of these sugars, those found in soda or fruit juices. Drinking liquid sugar is not the same as eating, say, an equivalent dose of sugar in whole apples. Fructose, by the way, is the sweetest of all naturally occurring carbohydrates, which probably explains why we love it so much. But contrary to what you might think, it has the lowest glycemic index of all the natural sugars. The reason is simple. Because the liver metabolizes most of the fructose, it has no immediate effect on our blood sugar and insulin levels, unlike sugar or high fructose corn syrup, whose glucose ends up in general circulation and raises blood sugar levels. Don't let that fact fool you, however. While fructose may not have an immediate effect, it has more long-term effects when it's consumed in sufficient quantities from unnatural sources. And the science is well documented. Consuming fructose is associated with impaired glucose tolerance insulin resistance, high blood fats, and hypertension. And because it does not trigger the production of insulin and leptin, two key hormones in regulating our metabolism, diets high in fructose lead to obesity and its metabolic repercussions. I will clarify later what this means for those who enjoy eating lots of fruit. Fortunately, for the most part, you can have your fruit and eat it too. The quantity of fructose in most whole fruit pales in comparison to the levels of fructose in processed foods. We hear about sugar and its effects on virtually every other part of the body except for the brain. This, again, is a subject area that's gotten remarkably little attention in the press. The questions to ask, and which I'll answer in this chapter, are: what does excess sugar consumption do to the brain? Can the brain distinguish between different types of sugar? Does it metabolize sugar differently depending on where it's coming from? If I were you, I'd put down that biscuit or biscotti you're having with your coffee and buckle up. After listening to this chapter, you'll never look at a piece of fruit or sugary treat in quite the same way. Sugar and Carbs 101. Let me begin by defining a few terms. What exactly is the difference between table sugar, fruit sugar, high fructose corn syrup, and the like? Good question. As I've said, fructose is a type of sugar naturally found in fruit and honey. It's a monosaccharide just like glucose, whereas table sugar, sucrose, the white, granulated stuff we sprinkle in coffee or dump into a bowl of cookie batter, is a combination of glucose and fructose, thus making it a disaccharide, two molecules linked together. High fructose corn syrup, which is what we find in our sodas, juices, and many processed foods, is yet another combination of molecules dominated by fructose. It's 55% fructose, 42% glucose, and 3% other carbohydrates. High fructose corn syrup was introduced in 1978 as a cheap replacement for table sugar in beverages and food products. No doubt you've heard about it in the media, which has attacked this artificially manufactured ingredient for being the root cause of our obesity epidemic. But this misses the point. While it's true we can blame our bulging waistlines and diagnoses of related conditions such as obesity and diabetes on our consumption of high fructose corn syrup, we can also point to all other sugars as well, since they are all carbohydrates, a class of biomolecules that share similar characteristics. Carbohydrates are simply long chains of sugar molecules, as distinguished from fat, chains of fatty acids, proteins, chains of amino acids, and DNA. But you already know that not all carbohydrates are created equal, and not all carbohydrates are treated equally by the body. The differentiating feature is how much a certain carbohydrate will raise blood sugar and, in effect, insulin. Meals that are higher in carbohydrate, and especially those that are higher in simple glucose, cause the pancreas to increase its insulin output in order to store the blood sugar in cells. During the course of digestion, carbohydrates are broken down and sugar is liberated into the bloodstream, again causing the pancreas to increase its output of insulin so glucose can penetrate cells. Over time, higher levels of blood sugar will cause increased production of insulin output from the pancreas. The carbs that trigger the biggest surge in blood sugar are typically the most fattening for that very reason. They include anything made with refined flour, breads, cereals, pastas, starches such as rice, potatoes, and corn, and liquid carbs like soda, beer, and fruit juice. They all get digested quickly because they flood the bloodstream with glucose and stimulate a surge in insulin, which then packs away the excess calories as fat. What about the carbs in a vegetable? Those carbs, especially the ones in leafy green vegetables such as broccoli and spinach, are tied up with indigestible fiber, so they take longer to break down. The fiber essentially slows down the process, causing a slower funneling of glucose into the bloodstream. Plus, vegetables contain more water relative to their weight than starches, and this further dampens the blood sugar response. When we eat whole fruits, which obviously contain fruit sugar, the water and fiber will also dilute the blood sugar effect. If you take, for instance, a peach and a baked potato of equal weight, the potato will have a much bigger effect on blood sugar than the watery, fibrous peach. That's not to say the peach, or any other fruit for that matter, won't cause problems. Our caveman ancestors did, in fact, eat fruit, but not every day of the year. We haven't yet evolved to be able to handle the copious amounts of fructose we consume today, especially when we get our fructose from manufactured sources. Natural fruit has relatively little sugar when compared to, say, a can of regular soda, which has a massive amount. A medium-sized apple contains about 44 calories of sugar in a fiber-rich blend, thanks to the pectin. Conversely, a 12-ounce can of Coke or Pepsi contains nearly twice that, 80 calories of sugar. If you juice several apples and concentrate the liquid down to a 12-ounce beverage, thereby losing the fiber, lo and behold, you get a blast of 85 sugar calories that could just as well have come from a soda. When that fructose hits the liver, most of it gets converted to fat and sent to our fat cells. No wonder fructose was called the most fattening carbohydrate more than 40 years ago by biochemists. And when our bodies get used to performing this simple conversion with every meal, we can fall into a trap in which even our muscle tissue becomes resistant to insulin. Gary Taubes describes this domino effect brilliantly in Why We Get Fat. So, even though fructose has no immediate effect on blood sugar and insulin, over time, maybe a few years, it is a likely cause of insulin resistance and thus the increased storage of calories as fat. The needle on our fuel partitioning gauge will point toward fat storage, even if it didn't start out that way. The most disturbing fact about our addiction to sugar is that when we combine fructose and glucose, which we often do when we eat foods made with table sugar, the fructose might not do much to our blood sugar right away. But the accompanying glucose takes care of that, stimulating insulin secretion and alerting the fat cells to prepare for more storage. The more sugars we eat, the more we tell our bodies to transfer them to fat. This happens not only in the liver, leading to a condition called fatty liver disease, but elsewhere in the body as well. Hello, love handles, muffin tops, beer bellies, and the worst kind of fat of all, invisible visceral fat that hugs our vital organs. I love how Taubes draws a parallel between the cause and effect relationship uniting carbohydrates and obesity, and the link between smoking and cancer. If the world had never invented cigarettes, lung cancer would be a rare disease. Likewise, if we didn't eat such high-carb diets, obesity would be a rare condition. I'd bet that other related conditions would be uncommon as well, including diabetes, heart disease, dementia, and cancer. And if I had to name the kingpin here in terms of avoiding all manner of disease, I'd say diabetes. That is to say, don't become diabetic. The death knell in diabetes. I cannot reiterate enough the importance of avoiding the path to diabetes, and if diabetes is already a card you're playing with, then keeping blood sugars balanced is key. In the United States, there are close to 11 million adults 65 years or older with type 2 diabetes, which speaks volumes to the magnitude of the potential catastrophe on our hands if all of these individuals, plus the ones who haven't been officially diagnosed yet, develop Alzheimer's. The data that supports the relationship between diabetes and Alzheimer's disease is profound, but it's important to understand that diabetes is a powerful risk factor for simple cognitive decline. This is especially true in individuals whose diabetes is under poor control. Case in point. In June 2012, the Archives of Neurology published an analysis of 3,069 elderly adults to determine if diabetes increased the risk of cognitive decline and if poor blood sugar control was related to worse cognitive performance. When first evaluated, about 23% of the participants actually had diabetes, while the remaining 77% did not. The researchers intentionally chose a diverse group of well-functioning older adults. A small percentage, however, of that 77% went on to develop diabetes during the 9-year study. At the beginning of the study, a panel of cognitive tests was performed –